mentioned yesterday about seeing the activities of Henry VIII. Well, we could easily spend 2 or 3 weeks looking at the history of the reign of Henry VIII. It is in some ways one of the most interesting periods in English history. The nation was in process of rapid change and development. Whatever else you say about King Henry VIII, he was a very interesting character, a very dynamic character, and one who was right in the center of whatever was vital in the nation. He certainly was not a good man. He was a wicked man in many different ways. His effect on history has been greatly overestimated. Actually, his effect is no greater, if as great as that of Frederick the Wise, who protected Luther. Frederick the Wise, if he had not protected Luther, humanly speaking, Luther would have been killed, and that Reformation would have ended there as previous ones had a century or two before. And it might have been 2 or 3 centuries before another man came along with the ability to really start. But in the province of God, Henry, Frederick the Wise, was greatly used of God. Now, Henry VIII is more interesting than Frederick the Wise because there is more confusion, more change in his attitude. But he certainly is not as good a man as Frederick the Wise, and his effect on history was shown in many different ways, and it's extremely interesting to trace them up. But the idea that Henry VIII is founder of the Church of England or founder of the Reformation in England is utterly false. It was Martin Luther who was that. It was the reading and study of Martin Luther's work that raised a body of university students who were men of tremendous ability and character who in subsequent years made the great impact on England for the Reformation. Well, we looked at one, the character of Henry VIII, and now number two is Henry's early attitude to Martin Luther. And that you are now familiar with already from our discussion of Martin Luther. We noticed that one of the, not long after Luther's work began to circulate, that Henry VIII wrote a book on the defense of the seven sacraments. A book which was a vicious attack on Martin Luther, and particularly on Martin Luther's idea. And this book, bound in gold, was sent to Pope Leo X, to whom it was dedicated. And Leo X, when he received the book, was so pleased with it that he proceeded to bestow upon Henry the title of Defender of the Faith. And if you see any official paper issued by Queen Elizabeth of England today, you will find that it styles her Defender of the Faith. The title has been used ever since by all English monarchs because Pope Leo X bestowed it upon Henry VIII for his attack on Martin Luther. Now, Martin Luther thought that the pamphlet was very, very poor. He said Henry VIII was a damnable and rotten worm, a sniveling, dribbling swine of a sophist. And Henry was not used to having such strong language. After all, he was a king. So he wrote to Duke George, who he thought was overlord of Martin, and asked him to punish him. Duke George wrote back and said he'd be very glad to do it if he could, but unfortunately, Martin was in the territory of his cousin, Frederick the Wise, and who was protecting him. He also wrote to Frederick the Wise and to others about this awful thing of Henry VIII using such language about him. But it actually was no worse than the language that he had already used about Luther. And Thomas More, the author of the book Utopia, which has been very famous ever since, Thomas More, who was a good friend of Henry, retorted by complaining of Luther's violent language and calling Luther this apostate, this open, incestuous lecher, this plain limb of the devil, and manifest messenger of hell. And so, the beginning of the Reformation, it looked as if the leaders of England and the leaders of the Reformation would be just as much in opposition to each other as with Martin Luther and his George. But that, of course, would not have proved absolutely what the future of England would be. After all, Duke George was just as much opposed to Luther. But when Duke George died, his territory was probably so infiltrated with Luther's teachings and Luther's writings that, as you remember, the whole territory of Duke George went over to the Reformation within the 2 or 3 days after his death, and Martin Luther was invited up there to speak to the great sermon at the installation of his church. Such things might have happened in spite of Henry VIII. They might have, and yet in many areas they didn't, where the king proceeded to use strong measures of the Inquisition of burning men at the stake and terrifying others where they wouldn't dare look at a copy of a writing by Martin Luther. But a change came in Henry's attitude. And this change was due to circumstances over which Martin Luther had no control whatever. And so number three is the problem of the divorce. Henry wanted a divorce, and the Pope wouldn't give it to him. Now you'll often hear the Reformation spoken of in simple terms like that. This wicked King Henry wanted a divorce, the Pope wouldn't give it to him, so he made his realm fuck. Now that is an utter oversimplification. The Pope had given divorces to other rulers when they had far less reason to ask them than Henry did. There was the situation is far more complex than that. First, as to why Henry wanted a divorce. When Henry was a little boy, his father, Henry VII, who was a very frugal man, and who filled up the treasury with his son Henry for two. Henry VII made an arrangement with Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, whereby his oldest son, whose name was Arthur, should marry the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, who was named Catherine. Well, with her, of course, the King of Spain, who then had already large possessions in the New World, and ships were bringing great amounts of gold over to Spain from America, sent a very large dowry with the daughter. And she was sent to England. She was 15 years of age, and so was Arthur. And they were married, and they lived together for a number of months. And then Arthur died. And that meant that his younger brother Henry, who had been trained up to that point for the church, and therefore had a knowledge of writing and of literature far superior to what most kings ever had, he then became the heir to the throne. And his father did not like the idea of having to send the dowry back to Spain. And he wanted to keep it. So he said, well, Catherine can marry the younger son, marry Henry. And so there's no choice on Henry's part in the matter. He was 13 or 14 years of age. This girl a couple of years older than he, who had been married to his brother aged 15 for a few months, was now married to him. And they could keep the dowry. Well, that was what was done so often in those days. She was now the wife of the Crown Prince of England. The youngsters had no choice in the matter, whatever. However, before she could marry, they had to notice that according to canon law, it was forbidden for a man to marry the sister of his deceased wife. And so for that marriage, they had to get a special permission from the Pope to release them from the law in that case, and that took a sizable sum of money. But the sum of money it took was very much less than what would have been lost if they had to send the dowry back. So Henry VII sent the money to Rome and received permission from the then Pope that she should marry Henry. And so she married the boy Henry. Now, Henry grew up, his father died. He was a fine fighter in the tournament, an able rider, a good hunter, and he had a knowledge of letters and of writing, which is what didn't deserve the fulsome praise that people gave to his writing on Luther's law, was nevertheless good. It was above the average job. And far above the average of the ordinary king, who was trained only in kingdomship and riding and directing an army and those things, and left all matters of writing and of learning to his secretary. Henry was trained in these lines above most things. But Henry had a daughter by his wife Catherine, and he was greatly disappointed not to have a son. Now his disappointment not to have a son was not purely a matter of personal preference. It was a matter of the well-being of the nation. And if he had not been aware of it, he would have been made aware of it by the attitude of the people. Because England up to this time had never had a queen. It had always had kings. And a century before, when Edward VI had left a large number of sons, and one of them who the oldest died before he became king, and his son proved unworthy, there was twice between two of the families descended from Edward VI, as to which would reign in England. And for 50 years they fought back and forth. One would be king a few years, then his second cousin would be king, and he would be in the Tower of London. And they fought back and forth, until finally the Wars of the Roses had been ended by the accession of Henry VII, who was slightly related to one of the two lines and married the daughter of the other. And the people of England had had 50 years of armies marching back and forth, and two conflicting forces claiming the kingship, and if you didn't favor one, the soldiers might kill you just to get you out of the way, and if you did favor him, if the other side won the battle, you might be killed. In any case, you might have your property seized. And after 50 years of that, the English people, more than anything else, wanted stability. They wanted law and order, and the only way they could conceive of having that was by having a legitimate king whom everybody recognized as king. Henry VII had had to fight several uprisings in his early days. But Henry VIII was the son of the king. He was established. Nobody questioned that he had the right to reign. They wanted him to have a son who could carry on the same stability for the nation as he. Well, it was a disappointment to have a daughter. But there was a good probability, surely, that they would have a son later. But Catherine had at least seven or eight mistresses, one after the other. Present-day scholars, many of them, suggest that Henry, in one of his many deeds, his various mistresses, had contracted syphilis, and that this was the cause of Catherine's mistress. There's no way now to know whether there's any truth to that. Personally, I rather doubt it, because he continued to reign until 1547, and he was a very dominant vital character right to the end, and I can't quite see how a man with that indeed will have as much strength and ability as he maintained all those years. But whatever the reason was, the fact is that Catherine had one miscarriage after another until the whole nation grew hopeless of there being an heir to the throne who could succeed Henry and could maintain stability in the nation. And you cannot say that Henry simply after a brief time got tired of her and discarded her. He lived with her for many years. He had not chosen her. His parents had married him to her to save the dowry. But she had all the honor of being seen for many years. But after all these instances, it just looked hopeless that she would provide an heir to the throne. And then, Henry, after having had one mistress after another, Henry fell violently in love with a girl called Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn or Boleyn, I don't know how it's spelled very slowly. But she was different from any of his mistresses before. She refused to have relations with him unless he should be married. Some say she had been made in waiting to Margaret of Navarre, to Sister Francis first in France. Some say she had imbibed Protestant ideas. There are Sobini, Arthur up to this, she was a very wonderful woman. She may have been a wonderful woman, and she may have been a wicked woman. Our evidence is not just sufficient to know it. But whatever the situation was, as far as her character is concerned, the fact is that she would not allow Henry to treat her as a wife unless he was a wife. And Henry had thus the wicked attitude of desiring this other woman for his wife. But combined with it was his interest in the realm, and if he didn't have that interest in having a successor who would be established and maintain peace and order to the nation, because everybody recognized that he was the one who had the right to reign, it would have been made pretty clear to his attention by the attitude of all of the leaders of England, who above all things wanted to avoid a return to the civil wars of the Wars of the Roses less than a century before. And so Henry sent a messenger to the king, to the Pope, and he asked the Pope in 1527 for two privileges for which he was willing to pay a good sum of money. And the first of these was that though Mary Boleyn had been his mistress for quite a few years, that this should not prevent him from being given permission to marry her sister Anne. And because according to canon law, one who had had a one woman for his mistress could not marry his sister anymore than if the first had been his wife. Well, the Pope readily granted him this permission. But the second permission, which was really antecedent to the first and necessary in advance of it, was that he be given an annulment of his marriage to Catherine on the ground that he had no right to marry her in the first place because she was the widow of his brother. That was the more important request. And of course, there might be justice in that request. However, there was on the other side that after all, she and Arthur had only been 15 years of age. She'd never been a wife, they said, except in name only. This was not a valid reason to ask for a divorce. Catherine declared she had always been loyal to her husband. She was utterly loyal to him now, she declared, and there was no reason why they should be divorced. But Henry asked the permission of the Pope, and it was seen extremely likely that the Pope would have granted the permission, except for one thing. At this present moment, when the request came, the Pope was living in the Mausoleum of Hadrian, otherwise called the Castle of the Holy Angel, about three blocks from the Vatican, with an underground passage combining them, living there with the armies of the Emperor Charles V, occupying Rome, raiding and looting and looting and plundering. And Charles V was a nephew of Queen Catherine. Catherine's sister had been his mother. And Charles V was not looked with satisfaction on having his aunt treated in this manner. And I think with little doubt, Pope Clement would have been only too glad to give him the permission. But he didn't dare under the circumstances, when he was practically in the power of the emperor, and in any event, it was important to keep friendship with the emperor, to keep on good terms with him if at all possible. And so he made some excuse for not giving him permission to have the divorce. And Henry persisted for a number of years in his effort to get this divorce, but he did not succeed. And that created a problem for him, for the satisfaction of his lust and his desires, still more for him in his position as king and in his desire to satisfy the longing of his people, to give them an heir, so that when he died, there would continue to be stability in the realm. And here we come to number four, Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer at this time was a don, they call him, a teacher in Cambridge University. He had been one of the so-called Germans who had studied the writings of Luther, He had accepted Luther's views pretty thoroughly. Though he was ordained, he had married accepting Luther's claim that celibacy of the clergy was something that was contrary to Scripture. He was a don in Oxford, in Cambridge, rather, and when the king made a visit to Cambridge one time, he gained the ear of the king, and he said to the king, after all, he said, Leviticus 20:21, with which Henry was already familiar, says, if a man shall take his brother's wife, they shall be filed yet. And he said, that's exactly what's happened, and that's why I said, determined to get rid of her and to get a woman who will be able to give me a male heir. And the Thomas family said, after all, the Bible is the true source of our knowledge, and the Bible says a man should not marry his brother's wife. And what right did that Pope have to give your father's permission to marry passing to you so they wouldn't lose the dowry? He said, the Pope is not the Lord of creation. He said the Bible should be the source of the Christian's knowledge. Now he said, if you would simply declare to the world that you don't follow the Pope, you follow the Bible, he said, then you can proceed to recognize that you have done wrong, or that your father has done wrong in marrying you to her in the light of the Bible, and you will be free of this marriage. And you can marry someone else and give him a male heir. And Henry said to one of his followers when he left, he said, that man's got the right sow by the ear. And so Henry felt this man Cranmer was a good man to take an interest. And so he invited Cranmer to his court. And among the most important men in the history of the English Reformation from that time on, one was Thomas Cranmer. In fact, of men who lived in the 16th century, next to, of course, an entirely different category from Martin Luther and John Calvin, let us say this. There are more words written by Thomas Cranmer read aloud every week in the English-speaking world to this day than of Luther and Calvin put together. His influence in certain, not in the great ways that Luther and Calvin, but in certain very vital ways, his influence remains and has been tremendously vital to his faith. And humanly speaking, Thomas Cranmer would have gone on to be a little noted teacher in Cambridge University, perhaps writing a few things that would be buried along with many other very fine writings from that century, if he had not had this meeting with Henry VIII. When Henry VIII got rid of his powerful minister Wolsey, who was Archbishop of Canterbury and the Chancellor of the Realm and the most powerful man in England next to the king, Wolsey, who had hoped he would himself become Pope one of these days. Wolsey had been trying to get the divorce for Henry and had failed. And Henry got rid of Wolsey, accused him of piety, and dismissed him from his position. Chances are Wolsey would have been beheaded as Henry the Seventh tax collector had been earlier than Henry ordered, if he had not died comparatively soon in the midst of his affliction. And so Henry appointed Thomas Cranmer as the new Archbishop of Canterbury. And right here occurs what some think is the most reprehensible thing in Thomas Cranmer's history. Cranmer said to the king, he said, this Pope has no authority over England. There's no reason he should have authority over England. But, he said, the situation at present is that he got. And therefore, he said, to preserve the continuity, it would be good to have your new Archbishop of Canterbury receive the papal authorization to assume the office. And then after that's done, then if you want to
throw off the patron authority. He said that I think would be a very proper thing to do. And so Henry agreed, and Cranmer wrote an official statement which was kept secret, but given to the king, which declared that there was no reason the Pope should have any authority over the English Church, and the Pope had no authority to accept to appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury, but in order to preserve continuity, he would be willing to apply to the Pope and, as a routine matter, to sign all the oaths and promises that were involved in receiving it from the Pope. And so the request was sent to the Pope, Wolsey is no longer Archbishop of Canterbury, will you give the authorization to this learned man, Thomas Cranmer, who could see desires to have? Cranmer signs these statements, certifying to the his recognition of the supreme authority of the Pope in matters of doctrine, of life, and practical direction of the Church. He signed all the requisite papers that he had already given a paper to Henry, saying that he signed these merely as a matter of routine and that he didn't mean anything. Well, they were all sent to the Pope together with the necessary sums of money. The Pope sent back these papers, the ring and the staff and the special things as far as the Archbishop. And Cranmer became Archbishop of Canterbury, the position which, from time immemorial, had been the position of head of the Church of England. And then Cranmer proceeded, as he told Henry, I will proceed in proper fashion to take the matter through the court and to say that the Church of Rome has no authority over the Church of England, and we will carry out. We will point out the wrongness of your having ever been married to your brother's wife, and therefore that the marriage is null and void, and you will be free to marry another woman. Well, at this juncture, in November 3rd, 1529, a parliament which, as far as every show, seems to have been quite freely elected, a parliament which continued in office for about 7 years, leading on being 7 years. And this parliament proceeded to do everything the king wanted. Now that is not just a sign of the obsequiousness of the parliament to the king, because the king found the parliament ready to protest very vigorously at certain points. But the parliament revealed that the thinking people of England had moved far in their attitude toward the Church. 8 years before, they had had a great meeting at St. Paul's Cathedral in which thousands of leadership had been burned, and Cardinal Wolsey had given a speech announcing that limit hell that which is Martin Luther, whose books could not be read. And the chances are that the great bulk of the English people on their farms and in their country houses were ignorant of the whole business and were still following along in their ideas as they came to. But in London and in the very towns, the people who read, the people who thought, the people who talked with merchants from the Netherlands and other places had been reading Martin Luther's writings and had been coming to grips that this was the situation, and all the English people had for a long time said that the Pope had been very overbearing and autocratic toward England and questioned whether his control could continue as it was in. And so the Reformation Parliament, in the course of these years, passed laws which broke the ties with Rome, which declared that the Pope did not have power over England. 200 years before, there had been a law passed making it illegal to send a complaint or a suit to any power outside of England. During the 200 years, all archbishops had received their authority from the Pope. All important cases of ecclesiastical had been referred to the Pope. But now Henry accused the whole Church of England of having broken this law, and the Church was compelled to pay a heavy fine for having recognized the papal authority contrary to this law of 200 years ago. And the law against sending taxes to anyone outside of England, which was made 200 years before, was also enforced. And Cranmer and others pressed upon Henry that it would be good to have the English people have free access to the Bible. Henry had no use for William Henry. Thomas More and others of his close friends had been in bitter controversy with William Henry. But William Tyndale's translation of most of the Bible was put together, and another Englishman translated the remaining third and joined it with it, and they put it out under the assumed name, and the king gave his approval to it. And this translation, which you get in first, if you need Tyndale, had it in view of it, which is two-thirds in Tyndale, was printed in England, and a big copy of it called the Great Bible stays in the vestibule of every church. Either with pain for it couldn't be taken away, but three the people of the union. And the clergy began to complain to them when they were holding the services that people were so busy out in the vestibule reading the Bible and discussing it that it was hard to hear them as they were carrying on the service. But throughout England, with the Pope, with the King's approval, the Bible began to be used. Well, perhaps to turn our attention for a minute again to his personal affairs. I think that it's hard, because one letter speaks in Patmos once. Henry marriages to Anne Boleyn and Jane Seymour. While their names are not tremendously important, I think Anne Boleyn is one, if you ought to remember. They usually say B-O-L-E-Y-N. Some books say B-E-L-L-E-N. But the common spelling today is B-O-L-E-Y-N. Anne Boleyn. And we must also mention Jane Seymour, S-E-Y-M-O-U-R. Now, Henry became impatient to marry Anne.
They were carrying forward the going through with the tales for the carrying through of the divorce, but it was not going quite fast enough. Anne was already pregnant, and therefore he had promised that he would marry her, and it was necessary to marry her rather soon. And so they were secretly married, and then Cranmer pushed through the annulment as rapidly as possible, and so he was officially married to Anne Boleyn. And you might think that the whole effort was ending happily. Henry had the wife he wanted. She would give him a male heir to the throne. The whole thing was going to end happy. But things didn't work out at all as Henry began. And Boleyn died in the Disability. Another girl, they named the girl Elizabeth, but Henry was very, very disappointed. And then she became pregnant again, and I believe she had a miscarriage after just exactly there. But anyway, still Henry was very different. And then in addition to that, he began to lose interest in Anne. After all these years of longing for her, now that he had her, seeing Catherine died, Henry and Anne dressed all in yellow and rode in a boat up and down the Thames, having a good time the very next day after Catherine had died, and the people of England cursed Anne and thought it was very unfeeling, whatever they thought of it, right and wrong to the divorce. The sympathies were with Catherine, who had borne herself with dignity through it all, and she was very unpopular, and perhaps some of this unpopularity passed on to Henry. He decided he'd rather have Jane Seymour for a wife than Anne Boleyn. And Jane Seymour became pregnant. And he decided he must get rid of Anne. And then Anne was accused of having committed adultery with five men, one of whom was her own brother. Now, nobody knows. She may have been a good woman, and this was all a made-up story. She may have been a wicked woman, but whether she was anywhere near as wicked as the charges would make out, I think most of the story got. But at any rate, they seized these five men. One novel I read about it claimed that the chancellor got a hold of one of them and put a rope around his forehead, and tightened and tightened and tightened until he just couldn't stand it, and then made him
confess if you take it off to what he had done with the queen and the name these other men, whatever, we don't know. But anyway, the men were taken and tried and convicted and beheaded. And then Anne was accused. And she was accused and convicted and beheaded. And so she was beheaded and he married Jane Seymour, and within about 4 months she bore him a son. So his ambitions were realized. He had a son, and unfortunately he was so happy that he had a big baptismal service with a great celebration, and they didn't have central heating in those days, and Jane hardly recovered yet, had to sit through all the ceremony, and she got cold, and within the week she died. And so Jane died, leaving the little boy, and Elizabeth, the daughter of Anne, was pretty much under a cloud. She was pretty young. And Mary was much older, but Mary felt that her father had utterly mistreated her mother, and that, of course, made her feel all the more sympathy for her mother's religion, her mother's attitude. And here were the three children. And everyone, you see, is tremendously important in the future history of England, and tremendously important in the development of the Reformation. Everyone is here. So I very vitally be aware of all three of them. Edward, the youngest, the boy; Mary, the oldest, the girl; and Elizabeth, the middle. Yes? Yes. Yes. Great part of the system just seems fault wasn't in that. But here was the situation. Now number seven happened before all this had taken place. But I divided them for the sake of clarity. About the time he married Anne Boleyn, or shortly before, number seven, Henry declared to be head of the English church. And he declared that he was the supreme head of the church. Parliament declared it, that no one in England should appeal to a foreign ruler, that the king should be the supreme head of the church. Parliament having declared this, the king required everybody to declare allegiance to him, not only as king, but as the head of the church. And he promulgated 10 articles of faith, which he declared the whole church must accept. When Luther heard about this, Luther said, "This king wants to be God. He founds articles of faith which even the Pope never did." But Henry was declared to be king of the English church, and that became part of the title of the King of England. He's not only defender of faith, the title that Pope gave him, but he is supreme head of the church. And Henry bore the title, Edward, his successor, bore it, Mary refused to bear it, but couldn't get the Parliament altogether to repeal it. When Elizabeth became queen, she knew that clergy wouldn't like to call her head of the English at the church, so she simply called herself Queen of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, defender of the faith, ETC. And everybody understood the ETC meant the supreme head of the church, but she didn't actually use the word. But Henry declared himself head of the church. Sir Thomas More, who was the chancellor, could not accept this. And the result was he was put in prison and he was beheaded. Cardinal Fisher, who had supported the Pope as a king to most things, but not to these, came out strongly against the king being head of the church, and the Pope, hearing of it, made him a cardinal. Henry said, "Well," he said, "I'll send the head, his head to Rome to get the red hat." So he said his head. So that Henry didn't hesitate to kill all those who were in his way at any point.
that the English people, after the misery of the War of the Roses, were ready to submit to anything he did, almost, and Henry had that scorn of which Charles V had a substantial amount, but second, his son didn't have it all. But Henry V had it even more than Charles, the emperor, and no matter what he did, people loved him and admired him and supported him in general. He was able to get away with more so than he wanted. Now he was running short of money, and the people at large seeing the changes, they were reading the Bible, they said, what is there in the Bible about monasteries? What is there in the Bible about monks taking a vow of self? And the supporters of the king, who had spent all the money Henry VII could save, and was having difficulty getting what he wanted, said, look at these monasteries. People who had given them big legacies, they had big lands, beautiful buildings. He said, and that people are, men are living there in corruption and laziness. Henry appointed a committee, number 8, the visitation of monasteries. Henry appointed a committee to go and investigate conditions in the monasteries. And then they announced to the world how terrible conditions were. It was a very corrupt period. And they did away with the lesser monasteries. They either told the men to go to their homes, or if they wanted, let them go to one of the bigger monasteries. And the old men, they gave attention for the rest of their life. But they closed up the little monasteries and nunneries, and the king took them over and sold them. And he sold most of them fairly cheap. He made a considerable amount of money this way. Eventually, he closed all the big monasteries and took away their lands and their property, and either kept what he wanted or sold them. And then the king distributed pamphlets telling how they found fake miracles that were carried on. And there was a statue of the Virgin that was supposed to sit and nod its head, and there's on the screen and back where the priest could pull it, and a lot of things like that. They made known all of these fake miracles and everything that was done to deceive the people. And there was no opposition, not a great deal of opposition at this time at least, to doing away with these monasteries. Number 9, public use of the English Bible. The history of the English Bible is very interesting and very important. I don't know in 650 or anything in 650 is fine for it. We should remember the name of Tyndale, William Tyndale, a great translator, one of the great translators of history. A man who suffered and fled from place to place in order to get the Bible translated to English and distributed. And he finally was martyred. Then there was a man named Coverdale who completed the translation that Tyndale had made. He didn't have the last part yet. Tyndale finished it in prison, but he completed the part that didn't yet have from Tyndale, and they published it at first under a fake name. Later, they published the Bible under Coverdale's name, including those parts and the added parts he did. And there were various ones who set to work to make translations. I mentioned the Great Bible, the Bible in large volumes, put ordered by the king, to be put in every church so the people could read it. Number 10, Henry's later marriages. Not having found happiness in these three marriages, Henry tried three more times. It's interesting that his first wife was divorced, his second was beheaded, And his third one died a natural death, the same procedure of the next two. The fourth one was divorced, the fifth one was beheaded, the sixth one outlived. It's interesting, the story of these women, but it's not particularly important to our history, and our time being short, we'll merely mention the first three are tremendously important to us. The last three, not particularly for our history, except they are interesting. Number 11, the Pilgrimage of Grace. Northern England was little affected by the merchants from the continent and by the coming of writings and so on. And in Northern England, there rose up a very considerable movement against the king. Great numbers of people gathered to come to meet the king and to demand that the king re-established the church and the authority of the pope as it had been before. They gave these petitions, they seem to meet the king. Henry thundered out, "How presumptuous are ye, the rude commons of one shire, and that one of the most brute and beastly of the whole realm, and of least experience, to find fault with your prince in the election of his counselors and fellows?" And Henry went north to meet them. They decided to conciliate, so their leaders came. He met them, had a nice dinner with them, had a nice talk with them, listened to their grievances, and then proceeded to attack them with his army and killed them. And so he put an end to the opposition in the north. England as a whole was definitely on the side of the king. And the king succeeded in partly by guile, partly by diplomacy, partly by military force, in putting an end to these uprisings against it. Number 12, Henry's last years. In Henry's last years, he had his heir to the throne. He had his position as supreme lord of the church. Everybody was satisfied as far as he could see. Now he didn't want to have a real movement in a Protestant direction. They moved quite a way. But Henry proceeded in a retrograde direction. He proceeded to order certain changes in the church back in the direction of the Roman Catholic tradition and superstition. And he burned people at the stake who were disgusted and refused to go along with it. And he took a strongly persecuted, really Protestant movement in the country, though still maintaining separation from Rome, himself as head of the church. He couldn't just do away with their reading the Bible, but he said ignorant and unlearned people couldn't read the Bible. It should only be read by the learned. And he was making movements back. At one time there, Henry was out of the country for a brief time, and they found that his last wife was a thoroughgoing Protestant, and she made statements which fit with the attitude of 10 years earlier and didn't fit with the attitude then. And the clergy brought charges of heresy against her. Well, when Henry got back, he immediately told them that they had no business interfering with the royal family. It was a play that was much advertised a few years ago. It was called The Ladies Not for Burning, written recently. That was about his last one. I haven't read the play. I don't know anything otherwise about it, but I did read that it's related to that period. But before Henry died in 1547, he gave the order as to what the succession should be to the throne. Edward VI should succeed him. He was 10 years old. He should be king when Henry died. Now, if Edward should die without children, he should be succeeded by the oldest daughter, Mary, the daughter of Catherine. And if she should die without children, she should be succeeded by Elizabeth, the second wife. And if she should die without children, she should be succeeded by the children of Henry's sister, Mary, who had married an English nobleman. He gave this order, and so great was the English love for King Henry that this order was carried out in succeeding years and considered almost a whole. And when people opposed it, they were put down ruthlessly by the nation as a whole. Although his three children were as different from each other as any three people could be. So capital D is the reign of Edward VI, and you ought to know the dates of Edward VI. Edward VI reigned from 1547 to 1558. Now, I think next semester I'll tell you something more of the detail of the reign of Edward VI. Instead of that, right now, I want to give a very quick summary of the difference between these three children and what happened. Edward VI was king at the age of 10. He was the son of James Seymour. He had an interest in theology. He had a love for Protestantism. Cranmer was one of the Board of Regents, and he had tremendous love for Cranmer. And during these 6 years, the laws for the burning of heretics were repealed. People were given a very considerable amount of freedom. People from the continent were invited over
leaders were invited of Protestantism to help in the establishment of the true church in England. As you remember, Brewster, who was converted by Luther shortly after the theses were put up. In Luther's visit to South Germany at that time, Brewster came to England and taught in the universities at this time. They brought John Alaskie from Poland. They brought other leaders from the continent. They established new books of prayer to be used in all the churches, and Cranmer wrote these. And Cranmer's wonderful English style made the great beauty and the wonderful evangelical teaching of the English Book of Prayer. That was Thomas Cranmer's writing. And it was a wonderful piece of work and has done tremendous good to people during this few years. If I'm in a little town and I don't know what the churches are there, and I find there are two churches there, an Episcopal church and a Baptist church, there's one chance in three if I go to the Baptist church, I'll hear a good gospel message, and two churches in three that if I go there, I'll hear a right modernist message, but I won't get anything else. If I go to the Episcopal church, I know the chances are 9 out of 10 there'll be a rank modernist message, but that won't be everything. There will also be a period of the reading of those beautiful words that Thomas Graham Cranmer wrote, expressing the gospel and true Christian teaching, said by him and said by the people. Even if after they finish it, the minister gets up for 15 minutes and denies everything that's been said, you get a blessing to your soul from hearing that. Whereas if you go to a modernist Baptist church, you get nothing but a curse and feel you wish you'd stay home instead of going. So Cranmer has had an influence through that wonderful book of prayer that he wrote to this day. And unfortunately, many, many people listen to it, and it just is in one ear and out the other. But I have known many people who brought up in the Episcopal Church with modernist ministry have nevertheless had Cranmer's beautiful presentation in the book of prayer sink into their heads, so that when they heard the gospel, they were all ready to receive it and to become ardent Christian leaders. And Cranmer has had an influence to this day in that way. But during the reign of Edward VI, Protestantism moved forward rapidly, and then Edward VI died and was succeeded by Mary, who was devoted to the Pope and determined to make England thoroughly Roman Catholic. And according to the law, she was head of the church, but she didn't want to be head of the church. She wanted the Pope to be head of the church. And some of the Protestants fled to the continent. Others stayed in England, but Mary proceeded to try to win the English people to Roman Catholicism, and when she couldn't win them in a couple of years, she started to use force, and she burned people at the stake. Thomas Cranmer, she said, Thomas Cranmer, you must declare you believe in that the Queen is head of the church. And she said, certainly, I believe that monarch of England is head of the church. We'll write it up. So he wrote it up. Then they said, Thomas Cranmer, you've done things in the past that affront the Queen. You must write a confession of that. All right, he wrote a confession. I'm sorry I ever said anything that this place to think. Then they said, Thomas Cranmer, the Queen says that the Mass is all right. You should admit you've made mistakes in the past. All right, he wrote that out. And they did one thing after another, 6 things. They had him in prison until the 6th thing practically denied everything he'd ever said. And they got those signatures from this man who was afraid of his life of physical pain and who for the last 30 years had been doing whatever the king said, but trying to be gracious to move in the Protestant direction. And he goes and he did. And now he did what Mary said up to that point. And then they said, now, Henry, now, Samuel, we're going to have a big public meeting. We want you to tell the world how everything you did before was wrong. The Pope is right, the Mass is right, and all this, and they brought Cranmer before the great assembly, and now Cranmer's conscience had passed the point he could stand it, and Cranmer faced the assembly, and he said, I have done wrong in the past. He said, through fear of physical pain, I've gone against what I believe. He said, the Mass is idolatry, the Pope is Antichrist. This woman here who is queen is trying to lead you into sin. You should stand by what we presented in the days of her brother, Edward VI, and so on. And they were so angry, they took him out and put him before the stakes to burn him. And he took his right hand as he stood before this man who was so afraid of physical pain that he gave in all this to keep from suffering. They stood him before the burning fire. And as he stood before the king, he took his right arm and held it out in the fire and held it there until the flame completely burned his hand and arm to it. And he said, this arm which signed those lying recantations to his fear, I destroy it first. And thus, he made an impression on all England of his eventual loyalty to the truth. And if Mary had died 40 years, all the Protestant leaders would have been killed in England, and England would today be as devoid of the gospel as formerly. But in the providence of God, Mary died after 5 years, and the result of her reign was to make the people in England who had been indifferent before see the loyalty and courage of the martyrs, and to establish in England an attitude in which it was easy for the Reformation to go forward with power under Elizabeth. We'll look at the details of these two reigns a little more next semester.